This is day six of this October 2014 seven-day session. And today we'll take up a koan. This is number one in the Blue Cliff record collection. It's generally the second major collection worked on by students of teachers who offer koan work. And this is Bodhidharma's I Don't Know. First, the case. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the first principle of the holy teachings?" Bodhidharma said, "Emptiness without holiness." The emperor said, "Who is standing before me?" Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." And then there's the second part of the koan. I'll wait till later to read that, rather than getting too far ahead. Even though Bodhidharma lived some 1,500 years ago, we have some information about him. A lot of what's presented in the old texts is clearly legend, but there's other stuff that scholars agree on. He was born in a southern port city, in the very southern tip of India. He's considered the 28th patriarch after the Buddha. So 27 Indian, well, he's the 28th Indian, and then went to the Chinese, as we know from our ancestral line. He was the Dharma heir of the 27th, of course, Prajnatara. I'm reading here from the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. It says, "The event that marks the transmission of the Buddha Dharma from Prajnatara to Bodhidharma is described in the Transmission of Light," in Japanese, the Denko Roku. That's another collection of koans, as follows. "Once the 27th patriarch," that's Prajnatara, "asked, 'Among all things, what is formless?' And Bodhidharma said, 'Non-arising is formless.' The patriarch said, 'Among all things, what is the biggest?' The master said, 'The nature of dharmas is the biggest.'" And then after he received patriarchate from Prajnatara, Bodhidharma traveled by ship from India to South China, where he had the meeting with the emperor that is the subject of today's koan. According to one story, he returned to India late in his life, after he had transmitted the Dharma to Wei Ko, but they're not sure of much of anything this far back. going to read still about Bodhidharma from a really very interesting book called Zen Baggage by Bill Porter, who's also writes under the name of Red Pine. I got a lot of I learned a lot from this book. It gives more detail, more texture to the life of Bodhidharma. So again, he was from a kingdom that occupied the eastern flank of India's southern tip. Its seaport of Mahabalipuram was a major embarkation point for merchants carrying goods between India and China. And that was where Bodhidharma sailed from at the urging of his teacher, Prajnatara. The trip was slow going. You often have, in recounting the story of Bodhidharma, I've often said it took him 3 years to reach China. Well, it wasn't 3 years on the open seas. This points out that and ships in those days had to hug the coast, and he made a few stops along the way. And finally made it to Guangzhou in the south of China. And there's some uncertainty about when he got there. They've identified a temple, a Buddhist temple there in Guangzhou, where he took up residence when he first landed in China. Porter writes here that Guangzhou in those days was as much a foreign city as it was Chinese. According to the estimates of early Chinese and Arab historians, there were anywhere from 100,000 to 200,000 foreigners living in the city. But it was also a transient population. Most of them were merchants and seamen, and they were always on the move, traveling back and forth between China and the various kingdoms of South and Southeast Asia. The temple that where he took up residence was in the part of the city set aside for foreigners. Says here it's likely it began simply as a temporary residence for Indian monks. But eventually it became a monastery, one of the four largest in the city. It was called Shilai, from the west, which was a reference to the place of origin of its residence, as well as to one of the most popular koans given to students of Zen. Why did Bodhidharma come from the west? And then in the 17th century, the name was changed to Hualin, or Flowering Grove. And now a little bit of historical context of when Bodhidharma got there. It says that by the time that the Han Dynasty collapsed, a couple hundred years before Bodhidharma got to China, people were sufficiently alienated from Confucian orthodoxy to consider alternative views of the world and their place in it. You could say a kind of a similar thing has been happening here in this 20th and 21st century. There are enough of us who did not find our own Christianity or even Judaism compelling enough to stay in those faiths and tried this other thing called Buddhism. Buddhism at that time was viewed by many as a foreign variety of Taoism. When Buddhist temples first appeared in China, they were built, as in India, around a stupa or pagoda. And there's this one, the most incredible pagoda ever constructed. It was built by a Chinese empress just before Bodhidharma got there, and was over 300 feet high. It could be seen from 30 miles away, and the sound of the golden wind chimes that hung from its eaves could be heard across the entire city. The pagoda was built of wood, a lot of wood, and when it caught fire in 534, it burned for 3 months. And according to one of the old records, an Indian monk named Bodhidharma called the pagoda the most incredible piece of architecture he had ever seen. And of course, the pagoda is gone itself, but the foundation is still there, even now. Just to be clear, there were some 400 to 500 years of Buddhism in China before Bodhidharma got there. So there had been Buddhism for quite a while, but not what we call Zen or Chan. Now, there was this monasteries there. There's a monastery there called Kungshang, where Bodhidharma spent some time. It began as a way station for monks, and it gradually developed into a major monastery where as many as 800 monks lived and where countless pilgrims came to light incense. Bodhidharma was said to have spent a number of years there. It was still forested then. Red Pine says here it was probably at his request that his remains were interred there following his death. Rumor has it that some kind of records say that Bodhidharma died of poison. His Dharma heir Wei Ke, who supposedly cut off his arm standing in the snow and begged for Bodhidharma's teaching. It says here that, from an early account, that Wei Ke's forearm was cut off by bandits. It's a little different version of it. And Red Pine says, if that was true, it's quite possible the bandits were simply the henchmen of jealous monks. It was not a good time for Zen. The Buddhists of North China, these are not Zen Buddhists, but the ones who are already there, were into works, ascetic practices, meditation that was aimed at suppressing the passions, shamanistic incantations and magic. The emphasis was on doing something and getting something in return. In other words, merit. They could not comprehend the usefulness of doing nothing and getting nothing. Weird. Zen was crazy, if not dangerous, for it called into question the understanding of those who consider themselves the purveyors of the means to liberation. It was said that when Bodhidharma died in 536, it was the result of the sixth attempt on his life, all by poison. Assassinations were common even in religious circles. There are people, there probably always have been people, and there probably always will be people who are so idealistic that when they hear these very unsavory things about religious people, they think that, well, then what's the point of religion? But those of us who practice any religion or spiritual practice have greed, anger, and delusion. That's what brings us to a religious practice. And whatever transformation there might be, and I say might, thinking more to these other pre-Zen practices, ascetic practices and magic and incantations, whatever transformation might arise from that might take a long, long time. And in the meantime, these basic human afflictions are being played out in monasteries and temples and churches. And well, now back to the koan. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? So the emperor had apparently gotten wind of this iconoclastic Buddhist monk from China who said that the ultimate doing is non-doing, and that there was ultimately nothing to attain because we have always been there. It's our nature. And he wanted to, he called for Bodhidharma to have an audience with him. Possibly the emperor's advisors suggested to him that if he could open up with the question, what is the first principle? What is the essential principle of this great holy teaching, the Dharma? And to his shock, Bodhidharma replied, emptiness without holiness. Emptiness. Imagine everything you know about Buddhism as it has functioned in your country for centuries, everything you know is based on merit, of doing good things, avoiding bad things. For non-monks, it meant making donations, somehow offering support. If you're wealthy enough, becoming a patron for Buddhist monks so that you could just get enough merit and that you might have a favorable rebirth. In other words, it's all about doing, accomplishing. And there was again this reverential attitude toward this teaching from India called Buddhism. And so then Vinaya Bodhidharma says emptiness without holiness. That's the first point of the koan that the student has to understand and present his or her understanding. It's a profound kind of infinitely far-reaching answer. In fact, there's a capping phrase. Capping phrases are still in Japan, are still part of the koan curriculum, where after you have successfully presented your understanding of a koan, then you have to rummage through a book with hundreds of phrases or little passages from just general literature and the words of masters, and come up with one of these phrases to cap off your understanding of the koan. I haven't heard of that being done in this country, so we don't do that. But for this line, Bodhidharma's response, emptiness without holiness, one capping phrase suggested for it is, one slab of iron stretching 10,000 miles. Emptiness. From the very beginning, there's never been a single thing of any enduring substance. There's only flux. We ourselves are this flux. Everything we touch is in flux. Everything we see, hear, smell, taste, feel, and think about, certainly, thoughts, are nothing but flux. Change. Everything is in process, including we ourselves. I've read from several sources that the Hopi Native American nation, the Hopi, don't have many nouns. Instead of saying table, the translation would be tabling, or instead of saying candle, candling, or instead of saying frank, a person, would be franking. This is a fascinating way of describing how things really are. Everything is in process. Nothing static. Nothing static except nothing itself. No thingness. This is the changeless aspect of this world of change. Now, bear in mind that the emperor had done an awful lot of things as emperor in support of Buddhism as it was before Bodhidharma, that he would naturally reckon had earned him lots of merit. He had built temples, supported hundreds, maybe thousands of monks. So he may very well have been asking for confirmation. Look at me. Look what I have done for your teaching, Bodhidharma. your religion. Now, please tell me, what is the first principle? Emptiness. What merit? He's really asking, what merit have I acquired? How much? I don't know what units they measure merit in, but somehow he wanted to be assured of his afterlife. No merit at all. No such thing, ultimately. Now, actually, that's an incomplete answer, no merit or emptiness, because in fact this law of causation means that what we do and also what we say and what we think creates karmic effects, and if we are exercising our innate compassion and doing good works and helping people in any number of ways, then from that perspective, that side of the equation is, yes, we are acquiring merit. But as soon as you call it merit, then it becomes this accounting quality. And in any case, it's not like we can just put it in a safety deposit box and have it stay there unchanged. Everything we're doing, all of our responses, all of our reactions to people, to situations, circumstances, all of this ongoing fluid process, there's the word again, all of that is adding or subtracting from our karmic balance sheet, our merit. According to Buddhist teaching, to be born into a favorable circumstances with a fairly comfortable life with supportive parents and surroundings, all of this is a sign of having done good things in the past, helpful things, compassionate things in the past, in a former life. So that's the other side of it. And one of the first of the things that earn us merit is giving, generosity. The problem only becomes if we just see it only in terms of this accounting system, and instead if we don't see that ultimately such things have no substance to them, the other side is emptiness. Bodhidharma no doubt saw that the emperor had gotten pretty clear about the merit side, the karma side of things, and so what he needed was to hear the other side. But this is not what the emperor wanted to hear. Before he sent Bodhidharma off, he had one more question for him. Who is standing before me? So he had framed Bodhidharma as this holy man. And so when Bodhidharma said, no holiness, then perhaps he got a little miffed. And he said, what do you mean, no holiness? Aren't you a holy man? Come on. Who's standing before me? And then Bodhidharma, I don't know. I don't know. These are arguably the most famous words in Zen. Not in Buddhism generally, but in Zen. Well, one of the most famous, best known passages or responses. And this, of course, is the central point of the koan, this I don't know. We'll get back to it, but first, let's finish the story. So the emperor did not understand. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. According to one other account I read, the emperor was so fed up with Bodhidharma's replies that he sent him out of his kingdom. And that's why Bodhidharma went so much farther north, which makes sense because having come from the southern tip of India, he wouldn't ordinarily be drawn to the north, even colder part of China. Many of the pictures of Bodhidharma show him with a blanket over his head, around his shoulders, which would also make sense that coming from a tropical region gets to China, which is much farther north than the southern tip of India, that he would be pretty much cold all the time. So it kind of makes sense that the reason he went north, much farther north into China, was because he was sent there. He was sent out of the emperor, out of the kingdom by the emperor. Later, it says later, the emperor brought this up to Prince Qi, who asked the emperor, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" The emperor said, "I don't know." Prince Qi said, "He is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara transmitting the Buddha mind seal." The emperor felt regretful and wanted to send an emissary to invite Bodhidharma to return. Prince Qi told him, "Your Majesty, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still would not return." The reason that this famous reply of Bodhidharma is so admired and is still echoing down after 1500 years to us is because it points to this, he points to the source of all wisdom, this not knowing. Socrates, who was more or less a contemporary of the Buddha, 1,000 years earlier than Bodhidharma, Socrates said, "Wisdom begins in wonder." And in Zen, there is this saying that the grand round mirror of wisdom is black as pitch. And that's really what Bodhidharma's, the method he brought to China of facing a wall, silence, looking into the mind, why this is so vital and right at the core of Zen practice is because we have to see through knowledge, that is what we have acquired in the way of ideas, concepts, opinions, notions, facts, data. That's, none of that is wisdom. That's knowledge. That's information. don't get wisdom from Google. Picasso had an early take on that long before there was Google. He said, computers are useless. They only give you answers. Answers are not wisdom. Wisdom comes from not knowing. And every particular Zen practice, breath practice, koans, shikantaza, each one in its own way is a kind of a delivery system by which we access this realm of not knowing. That is the source of it all. With koans go about this in a particularly exacting way by offering us the element of questioning. The fastest way to resolve a koan is by applying questioning to it. We can't question and hold on to our ideas and notions and concepts. We can't do it at the same time. That's the magnificent thing about questioning. If we're questioning, we're in a state of non-clinging, not holding on. And to the degree that we're questioning, of course, there are different degrees. We can be kind of mechanically questioning, or we can be really wondering, probing. And to the degree that we are truly questioning, to that degree, we will be free of thoughts. There's a wonderful phrase I once read about spiritual practice. Maybe it was Zen. Proceed toward the obscure and unknown through the still obscure and unknown. That's the real thing. Not memorizing, not studying, but delving into, groping in the dark. Leads us to the well of understanding, true understanding, that's our own, not learned. In Shibayama Roshi's book, Zen Comments on the Mumonkan, he talks about the power of the koan to dissolve our mental clingings, our mental attachments. He compares the process to a blind man. He says, suppose here is a completely blind man who trudges along, leaning on his stick and depending on his intuition. The role of the koan is to mercilessly take the stick away from him and to push him down after turning him around. Now the blind man has lost his sole support and will not know where to go or how to proceed. He will be thrown into the abyss of despair. In this same way, the koan will mercilessly take away all our intellect and knowledge. In short, the role of the koan is not to lead us to awakening easily, but on the contrary, to make us lose our way and drive us to despair. Make us lose our way. It's the best thing that can happen in Sesshin, is to completely lose your bearings. Not know where to turn, how to proceed, not know anything. When he says take away all our intellect and knowledge, of course this does not mean take away our capacity for intellectual functioning. That's not something that is going to be taken away, but to take away our reliance on these notions through which we interpret the world, that cloud our perception of things as they are, that those clouds, that dust, is what's taken away. What gets between us and the direct experience of things as they are, that's what's taken away. And it works with breath practice, of course, too. Any Zen practice, any classic Zen practice, is just serves to gradually dissolve our mental attachments. And this is not only in Zen. Meister Eckhart is considered one of the Christian mystics. Said, and I say to you by the eternal truth that as long as you desire to fulfill the will of God, that would be the emperor desiring to fulfill, maybe not God, but some merit agenda he has. So long as you desire to fulfill the will of God and have any desire after eternity in God, so any ambition, so long are ye not truly poor. He alone hath true spiritual poverty who wills nothing, knows nothing, desires nothing. Probably the last thought form that we lose through Zen practice is the desire to attain something. It's very deep. As a goal, I mean, we have to lose even this goal orientation so that we're just left in the dark. Goal almost inevitably, having a goal means having a goal for oneself to attain. But this practice is so powerful that even this will be scoured out of us if we persist. I don't know. Even people who have never worked on this koan can sense that this reply of Bodhidharma is different from the same words that the emperor replied when this prince asked him, does your majesty know who this man is? I don't know. And for that line, same as Bodhidharma's first reply, for that I don't know, there are also a couple of capping phrases I've run across in reading. One is, completely fills emptiness. Another for I don't know, Bodhidharma's I don't know, is, the moon is bright, the wind is pure. if we are secure in this mind of non-abiding, non-clinging, if we are really absorbed in our practice, whatever it is, we don't need to know. That's the incredible, mysterious thing about these practices, is that they become our navigation system, just holding fast to the breath or to the koan. That there we're safe with that. We're not going to go astray. Every other thing we're doing with our mind, we're going to go astray, but not with this holding fast to the practice. There's this story of the salesman who sets off to drive. This is obviously not contemporary, but maybe the last century, the 20th century, sets off to drive from New York to Chicago, and somewhere along the way he gets mixed up, and he ends up off in some country road, and he sees a farmer standing in the field there. That's what they say about farmers. It's a man who is outstanding in his field. and he approaches, he tromps through the furrows there, and farmers were guarding him as he approaches, and he says, "Sir, can you tell me how far we are from Chicago?" And the farmer said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, okay, what about from New York then? How far are we from New York?" "I don't know." "Well, you don't really know much of anything, do you?" the salesman said, and the farmer said, "Nope, but I ain't lost." And then the prince's final words, "Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he would still not return." I close with these words of Zen Master Dogen: "Coming, going, the waterfowl leave no trace, nor do they need a guide." Or recite the four vows.